Do you have an idea for a podcast, but you don't know where to start? Maybe you're overwhelmed by all the tech or you're convinced nobody will actually listen to you. Well, I'm Shauna Game. After 9.5 years as a professional podcaster, at this show, Everyone's Talking Money, and 25 million downloads later, let me tell you the secret to a profitable podcast. It is building a solid foundation, your podcast roadmap before you launch. That's why I created the Podcaster Class, a fast-paced group cohort podcasting for profit 8-week style MBA program. The Podcaster Class is immersive, comprehensive, and insanely motivational. If you want to create a podcast, DIYing a launch is just not the way to go. In the Podcaster Class, you'll get the tools, tips, and strategies to create a podcast that resonates with listeners and one you can be proud of. Get this, 90% of podcasters never make it to episode 3. That's 2.8 million podcasters who just quit. So to be a top podcaster, you only need to publish 21 episodes, but you got to make them good. So in the Podcaster Class, I'm taking the mystery out of how to create, launch, and profit from your podcast so you can create a top 1% podcast just like this one. The May cohort is now open for enrollment. Classes start May 22nd. There are only 15 spots open. You are going to learn podcasting with me and 14 other amazing people. You can learn all the details at thepodcasterclass.com. Use code podcast when you sign up for $100 off. That's thepodcasterclass.com. I'm going to be real with you. Identity theft is on the rise, and you do not want to wake up one morning and discover that your bank account has been emptied, or you're overdue on credit cards you never even applied for. We talk about this often on the podcast, but you don't realize how much of your information is available to scammers on the internet and how susceptible you and your family are to identity theft and fraud. I know, it's scary, but now you can get your data removed with Delete Me. That's why I personally choose Delete Me. Delete Me is a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential ID theft, doxing, and phishing scams. I just started using Delete Me and I got my regular personalized privacy report. I was shocked what they found and removed. It was pages of information about me that I did not want online. Here's how it works. You sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. I cannot tell you how relieved I felt to have Delete Me. And you know, it's also a great service for your parents or grandparents to help protect them from identity theft. Delete Me is not just a one-time service. Delete Me is always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you do not want on the internet. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special price for my listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use promo code ETM at checkout. The only way you get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and enter code ETM at checkout. joindeleteme.com/ETM. Go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use code ETM for 20% off.
We forget this. We forget that there are so many things that our service providers wouldn't do, even on the worst day possible. For instance, your banker is never going to call you up on the phone and say, John, I just wanted to let you know that your debit card isn't working. And if you give me your PIN number, I'll get it all fixed for you. But we just wanted to let you know that. Never going to happen. I'm sorry. You're on the phone with a criminal. So hang up the phone in that case. There are just so many things like that. But the bottom line is step away from it and then go when you have time and validate or verify on your own.
Welcome to Everyone's Talking Money podcast. I'm your host, Shauna Game. There's no judgment, no dumb questions, just smart conversations about you and your money. So come on in and grab a seat. Everyone is welcome here. Thus far today, I have had over 75 junk emails 3 spam phone calls and 2 spam texts. And as I'm recording this, it's only the middle of the day. So I do my best to not open these, answer the phone or text back, but it's getting harder and harder to avoid getting tangled up in identity theft and fraud in this crazy digital age. We had John Bizzard, a nationally recognized financial industry fraud and security expert, on the show a while back. And well, you just had a lot of follow-up questions. So we knew we had to have John back on the show as part of our Summer Money series. I did my best to pick a few listener questions that I thought would really be relevant for us and John to dissect. So we talk about the average loss that a consumer experiences from a fraudulent event. A little tease. It starts with a 1 and ends with 2 zeros. How to nail the secure password game, the difference between identity fraud versus identity theft, and so many more important security protection tips that you're going to need to just get your phone notes app and start taking some notes. All right, let's set you up for security success and let's start talking. We did an episode a while back and our listeners really loved it. And I think, you know, identity theft, it feels like this huge topic, but the reality is that most of us deal with it at some point in time. I know that I have had to deal with identity theft, gosh, probably 6 or 7 times, maybe in the last 10 years, which is really scary. It seems to be coming a little bit more sort of fast and furious. John, as you research identity fraud, you know, are victims and these loss figures, are they getting bigger? Are they about the same? Are things getting better? I mean, is there any hope for us?
Well, I think there's always hope to be optimistic in the sense that you can self-protect and do a lot of proactive things to sort of stay above the general fray. And we'll probably talk about a lot of those today. But in terms of losses, when we look at current research, I mean, there's always a shift one way or the other. We had a really positive outcome with our recent research where we had 2 million less identity fraud scam victims. So we were very happy about that. Yeah. And I mean, it sounds really cool, doesn't it? Because 2 million people, that's a lot of small towns out there if you were to sew them together to get to that number. But remember the top number for us, there are still 25 million identity fraud scam victims and other victims as well. We estimated with this research period alone a total combined effort of $43 billion with a B, covering 40, I know it's enormous, and 40 million U.S. adults potentially affected and touched. As you'd said earlier, my eyes kind of bugged out a little bit when you said 6 or 7 times or more over a period of time. But it's realistic. I mean, the victimization over and over continues. And I think part of it, too, is we're getting more digital, so there's more to protect personally. And you, of all people, you're probably in emails and on platforms way, way more than even perhaps I am, too, which ratchets your risk up a little bit, I think.
Yeah, there's this joke in my family. Well, it's not really a joke, but my dad, who's in his early 80s, God bless him, love him to death, but he is of the generation where he believes that absolutely every email should be opened because, you know, you just never know, right? Like who the email might be from and what they might be talking about. And so he will open every single email. He will forward emails that should not be forwarded. And, you know, he does the same thing with his phone. You know, when it shows up, like it might be spam, you know, he answers the phone and I'm like, Dad, why are you answering the phone? It clearly says that it is spam. But, you know, I think that there's just, I don't know, there's this urge, I guess, when you get an email or when you get a text or a phone call that, you know, you should answer it. You should respond to it. But, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, that's pretty much the starting place, right, for a lot of identity fraud.
It's absolutely the starting place. And if we were to have an unauthorized thumbnail photo of your dad, we'd probably put him in the what not to do category right now. You know, it's a generational thing for sure. When I think about all the times that my mother would never hang up the phone on anyone, you know, that's just not what people in an organized, polite society would typically do pre, you know, digital innovations, certainly from, let's just face it, from the inception of the telephone all the way up through the 90s and beyond until we started using mobile. People weren't victimized in that same way. They may have people doing crank calls and hang-up calls, etc. But the kind of impetus, I think, for people like your father is give everyone a chance, assume everyone's good, etc. And that's really hard to kind of reshape with certain individuals. But in quick shorthand, absolutely, we need to avoid strangers. I laugh and sometimes I chuckle when I say stranger danger, but there's right. a reason why that's kind of like a word pairing. Staying away from contact and what I also call triggers from people that you don't know and things that you don't know about. It's a tough one, but we're trying to get people there. I truly believe, though, that when we were talking about that 2 million less victims, the work of so many financial service providers, people like me, people over at AARP, all the people who are really invested and want to see a change, it took a lot of work to just nibble off 2 million victims. But there's much to do, absolutely. And the losses mount up.
So we talked about, you know, millions, billions of people, like these huge numbers. But let's talk a little bit about the money side of it. What is the average like loss that a you know consumer experiences? Are there any averages for how much money like we're typically out in one of these identity fraud cases?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we look at that and we average it every single year. But I want to just say this to everyone: when you have 40 million. U.S. adults that are affected by this, if you divide that into a tremendous loss pool of, you know, $43 billion, it really pulls it down. The average, roughly, it's about $1,300. That's not to say, though, that some individuals are experiencing a $1,300 loss. They may experience, you know, up to roughly where we would cap it, so $5,000, $6,000. We sure hope they're not losing more than that, but you know, if the money's there and the criminal is really good at what they're doing, that's where the bad things happen. I think that's why the family cookie jar needs protection. You know, criminals just want, you know, they just want what's inside and they're willing to do pretty much anything to get that. And that means cash or merchandise, access to your other accounts. You know, that's why a lot of times consumers who become quite tone deaf to this, that's why we say you need a complicated password that doesn't match other passwords. You need user IDs that are different than other platforms. Now, saying that and making it happen are two totally different things. It's a lot harder to do. And for those of us that manage so many multiple logins with our professional work, just the idea of having 12 user IDs for your personal life and 12 complicated, totally different passwords kind of blows your mind a little bit. And so yeah, I can understand.
It's nauseating.
It is a little bit. I wish I had it up in the brain like that anymore, but I just don't. I'm not sure that I can legitimately say that I do that.
Okay. So like, how do we do this? Cause you're saying 12 different logins. I mean, me for what I do and running a business, I mean, I don't, there's probably 40, 50 different logins. And how do you manage it in a way that, you know, my husband and I, we always have this conversation cause we try to keep a document of like a secure document of all of our logins, but inevitably there's something that, you know, we didn't write down or we don't remember, then we have to reset it, then we have to go through the whole process and, you know, we get like aggravated at each other. Like, is there a system or a way or a program or like any way that can make this easier?
I wish I had a magic wand on that one. I was thinking that probably if we if we could do the research and figure this out, for anyone that's ever even owned like a streaming stick, like a Roku, when the Roku stick breaks and you have to go and you buy a new one, you have to redo pretty much everything from the ground up. And I laugh and I think, how many divorces have been created from...
A lot.
What is the HBO password? I need it right now. You know, so I can relate with that. And it is really hard. I mean, that's why it blows my mind when so many people have custody and share financial accounts, you know, because how do you just make that work like magic all the time? I think what you're both trying to do is logical. You know, you have to protect what you're writing down. And I think it's a little easier than some people might think to just protect that document, print it, keep it offline, keep it in a safe place. But at the same time, there are lapses in that. Also, the service providers are struggling mightily with authenticating when it's you. So if you go out there and you buy yourself a new iPhone because your other one died or you got tired of it, well, that's a whole new device ID. And so it can complicate things. So if you, as an example, if you were to obtain a new device, you didn't seek any guidance or alert like your service provider, and let's just say Amazon, and they're trying to figure out, is this really you? It may trigger something like a password change. So that comfortable password that you know in your head suddenly goes away, and they're forcing you to change a password and to perform some other authentication steps. So it can be messy. I wish I had like the right answer. I can't advocate password vaults necessarily. There's been a lot of high profile stories in the news about password vaults and, you know, things happening.
That breaks my heart.
I know it really is. It used to be something I felt a little stronger about, but I think, you know, that expression, you do you. Try to be reasonably secure, and the rest just has to kind of fall in place somehow. I mean, there's just going to be synapses where we're not communicating with each other.
What about when you're signing up for something, and like I use Chrome a lot, and it says, oh, we can, you know, like automatically put in a, you know, complicated password and then remember it for you. Is stuff like that good, or should we avoid that and just like make up our own password?
I'll just tell you what I do rather than advocating, because I think there's probably a pro and a con. For one thing, I do want some control over what that password is going to be, especially if I'm going to be writing it down and protecting it. And if it has to be something unique, I know the correct answer is nonsensical, non-word symbols, numbers, etc. The more the better. I refrain from saving things in my browser. I know that I have custody over my phone and my laptop, but at the same time, if I didn't, and I didn't have them locked, someone can easily pick up your device or borrow it for a moment if you have people in your home. All of that pre-populated information is there. So if you're logged in as you and I use your password, it's possible I could just slip into one of your e-commerce accounts and change the email address and the physical delivery address and a few other things in the matter of 2 or 3 minutes, and you'd never know it. So that's why I'm a little uncomfortable with doing that. That's just me being the spooky fraud investigator. I'm sorry to burst everyone's bubble.
It's scary and it's sad and it's depressing. And, you know, when we were thinking about putting together this episode, I reached out to some, you know, to our listeners to see, you know, what question they had. And there were a lot of questions. A lot of them were kind of, you know, phrased the same way. So I just picked out a couple that we're going to kind of ebb through in this episode. So the first one comes from our listener, Jamie, and this is much kind of what we've been talking about here. But Jamie says, you know, I feel like between all the spam emails, spam phone calls, texts, it's really hard to avoid identity fraud. Is there anything I can do to limit all these spam calls and emails, or do I just need to not be aggressive at opening them? So, I mean, what do you think for Jamie? Like, Should we just ignore this stuff? Is that the best way to do this?
There's definitely what I would say a better way. Just keep in mind, you know, most identity fraud victims are so spun on the compelling lie that's being told to them that they forget because of emotions. Maybe they're having a terrible day and it's also something really threatening to them. They forget to step off the merry-go-round and take a break, you know, take that little breath that you need. So this is why it's kind of important to, I mean, I've used this acronym forever and I really stand by it. Like the sea, if you were going to the beach or the vacation, you know, by the sea, stop. Just stop. If it's something that makes you feel so uncomfortable, if it's a voice call from someone, an email, text, smishing, any of those things, really powerful things, if it makes you feel uncomfortable, you should probably just stop right there. Don't engage whatsoever, because you need to evaluate and then act. And that's sort of like the concept of reminding yourself about the C. I think the most important thing here is you're probably being contacted by a criminal 80% to 99% of the time when you're engaging. So just keep that in mind. And also, you know, we forget this. We forget that there are so many things that our service providers wouldn't do, even on the worst day possible. For instance, your banker is never going to call you up on the phone and say, John, I just wanted to let you know that your debit card isn't working. And if you give me your PIN number, I'll get it all fixed for you. But we just wanted to let you know that. Never going to happen. I'm sorry, you're on the phone with a criminal. So hang up the phone in that case. There are just so many things like that. But the bottom line is, step away from it and then go when you have time and validate or verify on your own. So if the message that bothers you is, your sister is in the ER and she's fine, but she needs $500 in order to get pain meds, pay the ER, and then go home and be comfortable, and that scares you, well, let me tell you what, the first call you better be making is to your sister and not your bank.
Right.
You know, call her up. You would call her anyways. Call her up on the phone. What's going on? Where are you? I'm at work. Why are you asking? That's the sort of thing that plays out over time. We just get so excited and our brain does that funny thing where it sort of goes into fight or flight mode. And unfortunately, it puts everything into overdrive and we miss things that are normal cues that, you know, if we're relaxing or like you and I were just talking about this as kind of distant relatives to the problem. It's easy for us to say this now. It's harder when you're in the moment, but we have to get better at it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's especially, I think they're so crafty when they're talking about family members or, you know, the example you just gave, it's like your brain, just the first place it goes to like, oh my God, I got to help my sister or I got to figure something out. And then, you know, before you know it, yeah, you're out a couple hundred dollars that at least that you're never going to get back. I wanted to step back just a little bit and ask you like a couple of definitions of some terms, because mm-hmm. I know I can get these confused. I would imagine that probably somebody else listening as well. Is there a difference between, you know, when we're talking about identity theft and when we're talking about identity fraud? Are those two things the same things or are those different?
They're absolutely different, and it's a good thing that we're talking about this for just a minute. I mean, honestly, most people think that they're like these interchangeable accessories that you can wear on your head or around your waist, but they're not. Let me just say that when we talk about an identity theft, so anything that would identify you, your social security number, your where you physically live, your date of birth, all that sort of thing, if that is somehow stolen in the classic data breach that you read about online, someone comes into your home and steals the information, etc. But wait for it. There's no fraud or anything. You're just aware that the information has been stolen. That's just a straight up identity theft. You haven't actually experienced a net loss of any type. And that also means to me, you haven't noticed that anyone is logging in as you, because that to me would then move to our next classic term, which is identity fraud. That's when you actually start to see the needle move in a bad way. So your bank calls you and tells you somebody's, you know, accessing your accounts and we've restored your money, but they tried to take money out. Or you log into an e-commerce website that you use all the time and you look up the corner and it says, last login was this date 5 minutes ago. And you know that that wasn't you. Those are great examples of identity fraud where you're actually starting to be affected and the criminals are using your information. And then there's a third term that I'm just going to throw out there that I use a lot, and that's identity fraud scam. So identity fraud, you know there's a problem. You either found it or somebody alerted you, but you don't really know a whole lot else. You maybe don't even remember how this could have happened to you. So the origins are pretty vague. Interesting enough with identity fraud scams, because they're more social, a lot of the victims, the predominant amount that we identify, they typically remember the exact moment they received a phone call, a text, or they clicked on a harmful link online and they were embroiled to the point that their identity was stolen and used fraudulently. It's still identity fraud. It's just more socialized and you're actually experiencing it firsthand through kind of like the hands of a criminal. So it is a little bit more memorable that way.
Interesting. I like that you separated that out, because I can be a victim of identity theft, but not necessarily have identity fraud. I like that. Okay, that makes sense to me. And we're on a money show. We're obviously talking about money aspect here. You mentioned about $1,300, I believe, is kind of the average amount of identity fraud, which is a lot to me. You know, the stats are that the average American, I think it's 6 out of 10 Americans don't have $400 to cover an emergency. And so, you know, when we're talking about $1,300 plus, that's a large amount of money for a lot of people. I mean, for anyone to just to be out even a dollar is significant. Is there a type of person that identity fraud is targeted? I mean, is it wealthy people? Is it just, you know, average everyday people that maybe don't notice that, you know, a few bucks are gone and then all of a sudden it turns into the $1,300? Like, who the heck do these people target?
Well, it is an interesting point that you make. And let's face it, $1,300, that's more than probably the predominant amount of paychecks that I've received in the first, gosh, 15 years of my career. So yeah, it's mind-blowing to think you would lose an entire paycheck or a couple of paychecks to the hands of a criminal. I wish I could say that, you know, identity fraud affected bad people. We probably wouldn't be doing this program, because we'd be like, hooray, the bad people
we're
are
not
affected.
In the bad people bucket, yeah.
Yeah, we're not in the bad people bucket, but I think one of the things we have to remember, and our research supports it, that really, this isn't a rich person's problem, nor is it a poverty level problem. The primary difference, in my opinion, is usually the insecurity part, financial insecurity, that renders a more powerful emotional and financial response. Let me just tell you what I think that means. Our research shows that households that are under 75,000, and brace yourselves, folks, under 75,000 is typically considered not an affluent household. But back in the day, many of us would have jumped for joy if we were making $75,000.
Seriously. But
exactly. But if you're under that, you're considered non-affluent. That's a big difference. It's a game changer. We find that most of those individuals do care more. They also, interesting enough, want to learn how to be safer in their habits so that it doesn't happen again. But if you flip over to affluent households, the concern level is not the same, because they're usually made whole in most cases. I mean, you have to think about it. If you're an affluent household, it's easy to not be as emotionally invested in that, because they're usually the first to receive restitution. They might even have private bankers and people who are available to help them. So the other part of that, though, I think, if we wanted to sort of sketch out a thumbnail, would be tech adventurous people definitely fall into the higher victimization bucket.
What does that mean, tech adventurous?
You are the Snoopy cat on the internet. That's what you are. You like to try new things. What does that do? Let me go out here and sign up for, you know, a new free platform because I want to see what it's going to do for me. That kind of adventurous spirit often lands individuals in a higher percentile for fraud of different kinds. And it makes sense because you're not concerned about whether it's safe. You're interested in sort of like the tech appeal of that. And we discovered that is time in memoriam, kind of a little bit of the attribute of someone who can be victimized more often.
I'm sorry, but I have the best dog ever. Her name is Winnie Stardust. She is a mini golden mountain doodle full of life, and I would do just about anything to keep her happy, healthy, and safe. Today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. Your pet is part of your family and you want to do the best for them, but vet bills can really add up. We jokingly keep telling Winnie she needs to get a job to pay for her vet bill. That's why you should check out pet insurance. And with ASPCA Pet Health Insurance, you can focus on the care your pet deserves and cover what matters most. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customized accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping to ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you are least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independent American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer, is not engaged in the business of insurance. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I was paying for vacations all wrong. I was missing out on miles. I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? I don't know, maybe that fancy hotel upgrade that you have always been dreaming about. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. In those moments when money is just not moving as fast as your dreams, Earnin provides the financial momentum you need to keep moving forward. Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. You just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then you access up to $100 a day as you work, and you can leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. I honestly would use Earnin in lots of different ways, but what's on my mind recently is I need a night out. I need some good tacos to sip on a few virgin margaritas and celebrate you all helping this podcast earn 26 million downloads. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. Gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in Talkin' Money under podcast when you sign up. It will really help the show. Talkin' Money Under Podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank, subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. All right, that kind of leads into our second listener question. This one comes from Felipe, and Felipe says, how in the world do I protect all my financial information that is online? I have this question too, Felipe. He says, I'm really scared to think how much of it is just swirling around waiting for someone to use it for fraud. I get, you know, we've been talking about this in a little bit of circles, but is there a way to really prevent and protect our financial information? Or is it just kind of like we just got to do the best we can and know that, you know, identity theft, identity fraud is just out there. It might be like part of the game.
Well, I have a friend that rather comically describes some consumers as spreading their personal information like pixie dust. And so with that regard, we do need to be careful. My thing is, I just don't want you to go out there and immediately sign up for a platform, provide a lot of your personal information, maybe even a payment card for a company that you have no idea really what they are or what they do. You know, you haven't even talked to a friend or family member or anyone that says, hey, you should really try this and I like it and they've been around for a while. So there are problems like that. I mean, criminals will even set up sham websites to attract you to buy something that's normally really expensive just so they can collect all of your personal data. And you're never going to see that Gucci wallet, by the way. They just collected all your info. So it kind of brings us to Felipe's really great question of what do you do with that? How do you kind of secure your personal information a little bit? And I'm going to give you some really fast tips. Everyone's going to do them. But for one thing, it's incredibly important. We all have smartphones, most of us. I think the Pew Research Institute said that. I think it's like a 95% or greater smartphone penetration all over the U.S., yeah, if not globally. There's a lot of global economies that are just mobile devices only. So set up branded apps for all of your vital accounts. So if you have an investment, like a brokerage account, you have checking accounts and other accounts with credit card companies and banks and credit unions, obtain their branded app, meaning do not download it from Snapchat or some unusual place. Make sure it's the real one. And then set up a lot of alerts so you can get in touch with your money. You know, that's the problem I think that most consumers have is they think they have a relationship financially, but they're not in sort of like a deep yoga trance with their money that I would like for them to be. And it's actually pretty easy to set up some alerts. I love that saying. You know, I mean, you really have to care about this because let's face it, it's your money. If you don't care about it, the criminals do. So you need to care about it more than they do. So set up alerts through those apps. You have your phone all day long goofing around on eBay and Facebook. Why not take advantage of it and get as many alerts that says your account was just logged in? A credit card was just ordered. You know, your balance is zero or overdrawn. Those are kind of the reasons why. I think another part of this that is a long-term play, every consumer in the United States that's an adult gets a free credit report every year. Go out there and get your free credit report. Print it on paper if you want. Go over it and circle or highlight anything that's wrong and report it to the bureau. I mean, that's a really great way to figure out if you're being victimized. That's my story, see. I don't have multiple stories, but the one that was so jaw-dropping to me was a refi on an existing mortgage that I had. And when the credit bureau was pulled, the lender said, well, you have this bad debt. And I said, I beg your pardon. And it turns out somebody had opened a credit card, jacked up the available balance, didn't pay anything. And I had to take an effort, of course, to resolve that. And I did. But that was a surprise to me because I wasn't looking for trouble. You know, we need to be looking for trouble, for problems. Also, I think, remember, if you change mobile numbers a lot during the year are mobile carriers or devices. This sounds like kind of an old school thing, but it's important. You have to make sure that your bank can find you. They need your physical mailing address. They need your mobile number. Here's why. If I'm taking over your existing accounts right now, if your old address two apartments ago is still a matter of record, and your cell phone number, like four cell phone numbers ago, is still a matter of record, you're going to be completely flat zero overdrawn and never know it. While the bank is trying to mail you compliance letters, send you notifications through email or text, etc. So it's really important. It's not just a granny exercise. It's really, really important. Also, the stranger element. Refrain from engaging with a stranger. You know, this means don't text, hang up on people who call you that you don't know, delete emails that have links or messages that are just really troublesome. And the thing is, you have to be your own detective here. If the text comes in or a phone call tells you that someone's in trouble or one of your accounts is in jeopardy, probably a bold-faced lie. Rather than engaging through that medium, just go figure it out on your own when you have time. That's the other element of this. Sometimes people say it's a rush. You know, a scam is time sensitive. The faster that they get that hook into you and get you to react, that's when the scam becomes really successful. So we want to make sure that we don't do that. And it's really easy. I mean, who cares if you hang up on a criminal? I mean, you know, more people should do that. It's satisfying.
Yes. Right?
It's less calories and lower fat. It's gluten-free. You can hang up on people. It's okay. The other part of it is personal safety. And you do see these in the news. There was an elderly lady in the Washington Post who trapped an identity fraud criminal. Like, she was calling the police.
Trapped?
She said, why don't you come over to my house and pick up that money that you want? No. She knew she was being scammed. But at the same time, I just have to tell you folks, do not argue, do not engage with an individual like this, whether you think you've got it all figured out or not. That's police work. You have no idea how dangerous the people who contact you are. There are very dangerous former drug trafficking gangs that have reverted to a financial white-collar crime model because the sentences are less, assuming they even get caught at all. So these are people that, just a friendly reminder, they already have your address, okay? So if you say something incendiary to them, they're going to be ringing your doorbell. We don't want you to do that. There's no need for that. That's why we say just move along. Stay away from people.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here. Yeah. You don't need the can of mace out by your front door. This is not a time to be that kind of person.
All right. So we've got another listener question from Bobby. And Bobby says, I was recently a victim of fraud on my debit card for a lot of money. I only found out because I went to buy something I wasn't approved. So I called my bank and they said I only had $6 in my bank account, which was crazy because I keep about a $2,500 balance always for safety. I guess the fraud had been going on for a while, but I didn't realize it. I was able to get my money back, but it took weeks to do so. Should I use a credit card for everything going forward? How do I stop this from happening again? Yeah, I've actually had fraud myself on a debit card many, many years ago, and I was able to get my money back, but made me really hesitant to use a debit card. I never use a debit card overseas when I'm traveling, never, ever. I'm kind of in the same boat as Bobby, like really curious about, you know, debit cards versus credit cards.
I think that, you know, Bobby's got the right attitude of trying to figure this all out. It is definitely not a one-size-fits-all solution. However, I think of it this way. If you are spending, if you're just a digital consumer and you're online and you are buying from multiple different platforms and things like that, and let's say, just for conversation's sake, you're not affluent, you have a lot to lose, and if someone were to, say, steal $2,000 out of your checking account tomorrow, while you would perhaps be restored through your bank eventually for it, there is an investigation period where you're probably going without that money. You know, the bank is entitled to
investigate. How long is that normally? You know, well, how long is there, could it be weeks or?
It's typically like a 30 day. Occasionally it might get extended to 60, but the service provider has a right to figure out whether, you know, are you making a false claim? They may. And again, this is also where we're talking about people that, you know, have better relationships with their financial institutions. They may get a temporary restoration that could be pulled away from them later after the investigation. But the thing is, if you can't go without that cash and you need the cash, then maybe you should start digitally transacting and physically transacting with either a prepaid debit that you just can simply, you know, refill.
That's a good idea from time to time.
So that's always easy, as long as you're not paying by the transaction for it and losing money. Or you could use your credit card, certainly. At least with that, it's not liquid cash. I think the other thing that always concerns me is, let's just say that you have a magical life and you have $100,000 in a savings account, and you have your paycheck going into your checking account, and you have a debit card that is literally connected, or in the banking world, we would call it like it has a relationship, that it can tap into your savings where that $100,000 is, or your checking, which might have $1,500 in it. I would urge you, for those of you who have that scenario, how important is it that that card touched so many accounts? It doesn't have to. There's no law or rule out there that says that you have to do it that way. So making your accounts a little bit less accessible for criminal, never a bad idea either. Just on that topic. If you have a card that has a MasterCard or Visa logo on it, there will be an investigation. If you're not involved in creating, you know, fraud on your own, you're going to get your money back. It just might take a little bit of time through debit. So you might want to just carefully think about that. But there is a system, absolutely. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to be left hanging. They may just not be pleased with how long it takes, depending.
Okay, friend, I want to know, what are your money goals this year? Are you saving to buy a house or maybe a wedding or a dream vacation to somewhere tropical? If that's you, please, please take me with you. Or maybe you want to just grow your emergency fund because, let's be real, life is expensive. I want to make sure you reach your goals, so you need Monarch. That's why the Wall Street Journal named it the best app for growing your savings. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track progress towards your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. Here's what I love. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. You can change the layout of your dashboard. You can go between light and dark mode. You can create custom budgets and notifications. You can set up all of these automatic rules for your transactions and notifications, and so much more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving their product. Get this. They release updates every 2 weeks, and they even allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. This, my friend, is totally original. Plus, they will never sell your data to third party or show you ads. I think that's really important. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it is the top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this show get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. That's monarchmoney.com/ETM for your extended 30-day free trial. The weather is getting warmer. I'm so excited, and it is time to say goodbye to all those jackets and sweaters and hello to the shorts and t-shirts. I wanted to update my summer workout wardrobe for the long haul without, you know, spending a fortune. Luckily, I found Quince, and I
am in love. Quince is your go-to place from everything from premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless, 14-karat gold jewelry, and so much more. The best part of all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes those savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. Okay, I bought the dreamiest pair of workout leggings and a bright pink workout top to match. Honestly, ladies, I gotta tell you, these leggings you need. The price cannot be beat, and I feel like a million bucks wearing this cozy workout-friendly outfit. I've worn it for like 5 days straight. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/etm for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/etm to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/etm.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into The Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to The Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in The Daily Book Club.
Well, this episode is part of our summer money series. Like, I love to do a series every summer where we talk about money and, like, you know, like, oh, yeah, I should look at that, or, oh, yeah, I should check in on that. And I think this is like a great reminder of just doing a little bit of an audit on your bank accounts and your checking accounts and your debit cards and your credit cards and your passwords and all of that. And I don't think it doesn't have to take up a whole day, you know, but you could separate it out. But what you're saying, you know, just take a look at what is attached to what, and is it necessary that it's attached? I think it's just a great idea, or a great reminder too, to just kind of once over everything, because you forget. I mean, life is so busy. I forget a lot of times about passwords or accounts or different things like that. And also a great time, right, to just check in on your credit report and kind of see what's up.
Essential to take a look at the credit report. I think also, if people are lucky enough to be able to take a few days off and go somewhere, speaking of PINs, make sure you know what your PIN is. Because if you're stuck, let's say you're traveling and your debit card is replaced due to fraud, but you have a credit card in your wallet, if you do not know what the PIN number is for that credit card, sure, you can probably check into a hotel, but you can't get a cash advance necessarily, you know? So I think it's important to test. You know what? And how do you do that? Well, just drop into your friendly ATM and try to do a cash withdrawal against your credit card and see if the PIN works. I mean, or just do, you know, a general transaction looking at it. There's plenty of ways to figure it out. It's the same thing, honestly, as when somebody says, we've suspended your card due to fraud. Well, if you're really worried about it, go use your card and see if it works. I mean, that's the ultimate litmus test.
Right.
Okay. It works. Hooray.
Okay. So let's say that we've done our homework this summer, and we've checked our credit report, and we notice, you know, something on our report, and, you know, we want to do like a credit freeze or a credit lock, or, you know, we've heard these terms kind of echoed around. Can you walk me through, like, what do those mean? And, you know, what do we do if we notice fraud on our credit report that maybe we didn't know about?
Oh, sure. And I'm going to expand this a little bit and just say that credit report, if you get something from, you know, maybe Macy's mails you a bill and you have no idea, you didn't even know you had a Macy's account. Same thing would kind of apply here. So let me run us through a couple of things that I think this is very important for people to understand, because I think that a lot of times when you go out looking for certain things, what do you end up at all the time? You end up at the paywall for something rather than, you know, you're looking for, as an example, a credit freeze, which is free, 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 free to every adult in the United States. But you have to be able to find the part of the webpage at each bureau where you can establish a credit freeze. A freeze is something that you initiate that can suspend your credit if you're not going to use it. It keeps the criminals from opening new accounts in your name, leveraging your fine credit or even your bad credit. You know, here's the thing. Don't just say to yourself, well, my credit's terrible, I don't care. You don't want it to get any worse. You don't want anyone to tap into it and do anything else. This is something you can do for free. You pay zero for it. If you land on any web pages out there where they're asking you to pay for something, you're on the wrong web page. So close it and go back. There are three major bureaus in the country. They have really good web pages. You just have to look through these. So credit freeze is something you can do for yourself. That is free. You turn it off, you turn it on, put the apps on your phone. I bought a sofa a few months ago, and in the parking lot of the store, I turned my credit on so that I could get like the extra, you know, percent off that they give you if you open a store account. And as soon as that was done, I turned it back off again. So I get to control the narrative there. A credit lock, and again, these terms vary a little bit. That's when you do pay. And I would call a credit lock more or less like a product. So maybe the bureau.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So like a company or a bureau says, hey, you can lock your credit, but we're also going to let you improve your credit score and you'll get great notifications and education from us. And it's $40 a year. That's a product. If that doesn't fit what you're trying to do, then don't buy it. You know, just keep in mind, you can get your credit frozen without buying anything. And if you want to file what we would call like a fraud alert at the bureau, letting them know that you've been a recent victim of identity fraud, go for it. Simple. You know, you could do it electronically, but I like to follow up with paper. And I'd like, if I can, as we close, is just really kind of strike on some things that people need to do to manage their credit scenario a little bit if they've discovered some kind of victim issue.
Yeah, please.
There is, I mean, honestly, let's just go low tech. You can use a laptop and a Word document. If you're an Excel sheet nerd and that turns you on, great. If you're a ringed binder or legal pad person, just start to gather all of your info. If you started with your credit report and you see some things on there that are factually incorrect, including addresses that you've never lived at, jobs you've never had, accounts that have balances that you've never established, you need to start figuring out, gather all that information up, sit down and start a paper trail. And that usually means that you're going to write some electronic letters through the bureau because you'll be logged into the bureau with a user ID and a password that you establish. You're going to alert them that way. I want you to also write a simple paper form letter, and you keep that. Sign it, mail a copy, but you keep that. Let's say you are so low tech that you have a variety of shoeboxes on the dining room table, and you have a lot of vendors or companies to contact. File your paper by the company, not by the scenario, okay? So if you're dealing with Equifax, everything that comes from them and everything that you send to them, that goes into your email folder or your shoebox or whatever it is, so you can keep track of it for resolution purposes, because it's really important to document. You know, if you're not the world's greatest at things like this, figure out who your best friend or relative is that's that kind of person. There's always somebody out there that you know that they're just super organized. They love to do this kind of stuff. Ask for a little bit of help. There's no shame in that. You need someone that can pump out a bunch of letters. They don't have to be complicated. They should be very, very simple. Send copies of original documents, never originals. I know it kind of sounds like the first year of business school here a little bit, but you have to remember, don't mail your driver's license. Don't send birth certificates. Don't do any of those things. Try to conduct your business online when you can, but I'm really a fan of a paper trail. I really think it's important. And just remember, you're not a fraud investigator. So when you're dealing with companies that are asking you questions that you have no idea how to answer, tell them so. All right. I don't know who Victor. And quite frankly, it makes me a little uncomfortable when somebody tries to get you to agree that it was your adult relative who's living with you. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Right. You know, I think it's the job of that company to figure out if you did or didn't do this, create this problem. So I think that's really, really important. Otherwise, it's just communication. Don't sit on it. Don't be afraid of it. If you just don't feel like you can do some simple work like this, I really do think it's super important to just talk about it to your friends, see if anybody expresses interest, and then see if they would help you a little bit. Maybe like an hour a week. You know, you can't resolve everything immediately overnight. So an hour a week with the assistance of someone, that's pretty sweet. You could really do a lot with that.
So, my gosh, we have talked about so much. I think, you know, as I'm listening, I feel both really empowered by the tips and suggestions, but also like equally just not stressed out, but there's a lot to do when it comes to trying to protect yourself against identity fraud, theft, everything, the whole kit and caboodle. And I would imagine, you know, everyone listening is probably feeling that kind of dichotomy as well. What kind of like pep talk or words of wisdom or advice or little action steps would you give us so that we can both make this manageable, but also really protect ourselves going forward?
There are two avenues that I think you could explore and take. One of them is more of like a retail therapy avenue, and that is before, way, way, way before you ever have a problem. Maybe you want to investigate like a identity protection service. So there are plenty of those out there. They're the people who tell you that they're going to let you know when your information is being sold on the dark web, and they'll report your credit score to you. Some of them even say they'll help you through the struggle if you become a victim of identity fraud. Here's the rub, though, folks. Our research, unfortunately, shows that, and it makes no sense, people tend to buy these policies or services after they've become a victim, and it's useless at that point. So you've got to say to yourself, am I worth the $49.95 annually? Is my sanity and my time worth it? Maybe you want to explore that. Just if you buy one, look at a lot of them and make sure that they're going to do a lot of good things for you. That's probably the one sort of spendy moment. The other part of this, really, if you're not in need, meaning you're not refinancing or acquiring a mortgage for the first time where you're discovering this, the level of urgency isn't the same. It means that you have time to fix this. You just have to start an alert process, and it kind of falls in place. You don't have to be like a world-class administrator, but you are the administrator of your personal life, so you have to just kick things off. These companies that you're dealing with, they have a process for everything. Some of it is just verbal. You answer some questions on the phone, but you have to be able to devote a few minutes to be able to do that. But, you know, again, just remember, you want to protect yourself from this happening in the future as much as in the moment too. So, you know, take your time. Don't get panicked. You know, do things one at a time until you work your way through them. That might mean a dozen hours for some people collectively. It might mean more for other people. It just depends on how complex the problem is.
I mean, the fact that we have to spend this much time talking about identity theft and fraud is just beyond frustrating. a lot of words. It is so infuriating, and it only seems to be getting worse. I would have never thought about John's tips and knowing your credit card PIN number. I mean, that makes sense, and that's just blowing my mind because I have never known my credit card PIN number, but I'm going to definitely do that the next time that I travel. So put that on the list of the to-dos for this summer for sure. Seriously, there was so much good information in this episode. I am still digesting it all myself. If you want to connect with John, you can find him on LinkedIn. Just look up John Bizzard. And he is more than happy to answer any follow-up questions that you have. We will definitely have him on another episode upcoming because I just feel like this is something we need to be reminded over and over and over again. If you enjoyed this episode, do everybody in your life a favor. Share this around. Give them this information about identity fraud, identity theft, and how to prepare themselves. As always, you can head to the show notes for all the links to our episode guests, as well as the sponsors who make this show possible. All right, I hope you're sipping something amazing, maybe like a nice pina colada or a nice Mai Tai, something very summery. I hope you're enjoying a nice beverage, and I will see you back here in a few days for a brand new episode.